From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the pre-9/11 days of the summer of 2001, President Bush went on national television one summer night simply to announce that he was restricting federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. There was a moral line to be drawn, said the president, and he drew it at 78 stem cell lines. Almost 3 years later, the president's moral line is under sharply mounting pressure from many sides. Nancy Reagan and advocates of research into many diseases want a stem cell push. American academia and business fear being left behind in a profound global race. Now Congress is piling on. Tonight on Point, momentous shifts in the stem cell research debate. Who's moving you on the stem cell question, Nancy Reagan or George Bush? Do the needs of sufferers of diabetes, Lou Gehrig's disease, and Parkinson's outweigh the president's moral concerns? And if the rest of the world is plunging ahead, can the United States afford to stay behind? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Michael Lemonick, senior science writer for Time magazine. Michael Lemonick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what's going on, particularly in Congress, Michael? Just in the last few weeks, we have 200 House members, both parties, calling on the Bush administration to loosen its restrictions on stem cell research. Just last week, 58 Democratic and Republican senators urging the same. What's happening here?
What's happening is that there is a persuasiveness to the argument that stem cell research should be expanded that seems to be overcoming some of the kind of rigid prejudices against it that even conservatives have had up to now.
And this week, of course, given a boost as Ronald Reagan, who, of course, suffered from Alzheimer's in his last decade, is laid to rest, and Nancy Reagan gains such prominence. Why is it, Michael Lemonick, that the voices of people like Nancy Reagan, Christopher Reeve, who of course was in Hollywood, played Superman and the rest, and other disease sufferers seem to be more persuasive now than they were in the summer of 2001?
I think it's simply that the constant pressure from people, the pressure from people like Reeve and so on, Michael J. Fox, who suffers from Parkinson's disease, and other celebrity sufferers, I guess you call them. It's been on all the time, and they've testified before Congress throughout this period. But it's just that their message, I think, is slowly but surely getting through, and the arguments of those who say that stem cell research should be restricted, as President Bush decided a couple of years ago, find themselves on weaker and weaker ground. There just isn't a lot of moral authority behind what they're saying.
Michael, remind us of the basics of the science here. What are stem cells? How do scientists hope they might be used, particularly in regard to human disease?
Okay, well, what we're talking about here is embryonic stem cells. There are other kinds of stem cells. A stem cell is basically a starter cell that can turn into something else. And we have stem cells in our adult bodies, in our bone marrow and in other parts that can actually make specific kinds of tissues. Stem cells in the bone marrow actually make blood cells. But embryonic stem cells, you know, if you think about it, we start out as just a sperm and an egg, and the egg divides and becomes two, and then four, and then eight, and I better not go any further because my math won't fail me. But those very early cells, I mean, there are no eyeballs in there, there are no brains, there are none of the thousands of kinds of cells we have, and yet those one or two original cells eventually differentiate and become all the cells that make up our bodies.
So the hope of science is that embryonic stem cells could be used to produce body materials needed by disease sufferers later in life.
Right. There are all sorts of diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, where cells die, spinal cord injury, where cells die, and you can't just replace them. But if you were able to take stem cells, embryonic stem cells, and coax them into becoming heart tissue or spinal cord tissue or nerve tissue, in principle, maybe you could replace these dead cells and cure these diseases.
Now, the president said that he would only approve federal funding for 78 stem cell lines. What does he mean by a line? And why, we hear recently, that only 19 have actually been available for research? What's going on there?
Well, to make stem cells work, you first have to isolate the cells, and then you have to grow them in the culture. And if you can't do that, it doesn't do you any good. A line of stem cells is the stem cells taken from one embryo and grown to form a culture. And what happened was that when President Bush made his declaration back in 2001, he was using the most optimistic estimate based on the number of reports from around the world of stem cell lines that had been actually isolated from embryos, 78 different individual embryos. What has happened since then is that people have tried to culture them and grow them and grow them into enough cells that you could actually do research on them, and most of those attempts have failed. You can't once you isolate a stem cell line, that doesn't necessarily mean you can grow it in culture, and most of these have failed. So we really have 19 now. A couple more may come along, but it's much less than we thought.
That is from the number that the president was looking at. And he was saying these embryos are already here, so we'll use them, but I don't want this to go any further. As I understand, most of these embryos come from fertility clinics where many are produced in the process of fertility work with couples who need medical help in reproducing. Is that right, Michael?
Right, and that's why the opposition really has a very difficult time making its case. Every year in this country alone, tens of thousands of embryos at the stage of just a few dozen cells are created for people who are infertile. And what happens in vitro fertilization is you create more than you need because you're not sure it's going to take. So you create these fertilized eggs that divide a couple of times, and then you implant some of them in the mother. Well, if it works, you still have the leftovers that you were saving. If it doesn't work, you use those up. But as a result, there are tens of thousands of these 20, 40, 60 cell embryos frozen at fertility clinics. They're never going to be used. The parents have the child, and they're not going to have more. And so these are, I mean, if you are going to declare that these are human lives, human beings, why aren't you, congressman or senator, trying to close down these clinics? Why are you not shutting down fertility clinics if they're killing babies all the time? And yet, of course, they're not doing that because these clinics are actually helping people have children.
And at this point, even some anti-abortion congressmen are saying they're supporting more stem cell research. I'm seeing here Representative Randy Cunningham from San Diego, who supported Bush's original position. But he's saying he now believes the momentum is so clear that if reelected, President Bush might alter his policy. He hasn't made any signal to that effect at this point, Michael Lemonick.
Right, and he probably he I mean he can't really afford to alienate his conservative base, his right to life religious base. So by saying nothing about it, he doesn't offend anybody. It may well be that he will change his policy. The pressure is certainly mounting, and it's very hard. Certainly among Republicans and conservatives, Nancy Reagan is, through her association with her husband, is a conservative icon. And she doesn't ask for much. She doesn't, doesn't speak out very often. When she comes and says, "Okay, this I care about," it's pretty tough for Republicans and for conservatives to fight against it. And that's, I think, partly why you see this change of mood in Congress. And even I should say the majority leader in the Senate, Bill Frist, has not said he favors a change in the policy, but he has said in recent weeks he favors looking at the policy again.
Even Bill Frist, Dr. Bill Frist, that is. Today, Pennsylvania Republican Senator Arlen Specter spoke at the annual meeting of the International Society for Stem Cell Research in Boston. Let's listen to what he had to say.
When you have 128 million Americans who suffer directly or indirectly from the ravages of maladies which could be cured, and with stem cells on the cutting edge, I believe the challenge is there. There hasn't been a better time than now with so much attention focused on the president and the 10 years with Alzheimer's to pick up the battle.
To pick up the battle, says Senator Arlen Specter. And meanwhile, Michael Lemonick, private clinics are coming out with new stem cell lines. We saw a private Chicago fertility clinic announcing today at the same meeting they've isolated 50 new lines of human embryonic stem cells. So the president's policy appears to be leaking.
Well, no. I should have clarified it first. The president's policy only applies to federal funding. He has not banned the creation of new stem cell lines. All he said is you can't use federal money to do it or to do research on those lines.
I guess the point being there's nothing like a watertight seal here, either in the United States or abroad, where research is forging ahead.
That's right, and that's the other worry. First of all, in this country, private universities and companies can create new stem cell lines. The problem is they're much, much poorer than the federal government with all of its resources. So we're kind of handicapped here. And as a result, countries in Southeast Asia, I think Singapore is a big player. China's very interested. And in Europe, in Britain, and primarily in Britain, this research is going ahead, and the scientists who are really want to be at the forefront of this exciting and important field of research are being lured away to these other countries. So all that the policy is really doing here in the U.S. is sending our best researchers abroad.
Michael Leminick, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Michael Leminick, senior science writer for Time magazine. We're talking tonight about a shifting momentum in the stem cell research debate. Nancy Reagan, academia, business, and increasingly the United States Congress saying, wait, we've got to do this. You can join the conversation tonight. Who's moving you on the stem cell question these days, Nancy Reagan or George Bush? Do the urgent needs of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and Lou Gehrig's disease sufferers outweigh the moral concerns here or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Newton, Massachusetts, by Juan Enriquez. He's founding director of the Harvard Business School Life Science Project. He's chairman of Biotechonomy, a life sciences research and investment firm. He's on the board of the Harvard Medical School Genetics Advisory Council and is author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. Good evening and welcome, Juan Enriquez.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. How are you watching this whole continuing debate in the United States, Juan Enriquez, in the context of what's going on in the world? Is the U.S. finally breaking out here, or is it falling behind? How do you read it?
Well, you can see an example in Britain, because Britain, for a long time, had absolutely the best researchers in anything having to do with genetic engineering. They first discovered penicillin, then they discovered DNA, then they did monoclonal antibodies, and then they did Dolly. But one of the things that they weren't able to do is to capitalize on all of this and build a truly global biotech industry, and even their pharmaceutical industry outside of SKB, SmithKline-Beecham, is not of the scale it should be. The United States could easily put itself in a similar situation if it followed this policy where only the private sector pays for this research, while China and Singapore and Japan and Britain are getting very aggressive about public funding and private partnerships to push this stuff forward. And the reason why it's so important is because you have to think of a lot of what's gone on is we've been mapping genomes, and that's the software of this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the code. And stem cells are the hardware. And that would be a little bit like saying we're going to go into the computer business, but we're only going to do software. We're not going to do any of the hardware. And maybe you can do that at later stages in the computer revolution, but you certainly don't want to do that at the beginning.
And Juan Enriquez, how important is federal funding in all this? President Bush says, I will fund this and no more. Can the private sector simply run with the rest? Does it matter? Or do you think pressure is going to mount on him to change that restriction, that policy?
I think there's going to be huge pressure because we're beginning to learn more and more about how to differentiate cells. So we're beginning... A series of companies are thinking about how do you regrow your own skin if you've been through burns? How do you regrow part of your eye tissue if you've lost part of your eyes to cataracts or some other thing? How do you regrow your islet cells in your pancreas if you've got diabetes? Even how do you regrow a limb if you've lost a limb? And we're not there yet. But to get there, one of the things that's going to be critical is the ability to execute the code that we're beginning to learn. And that's where stem cells come in.
Juan Enriquez, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about a shifting momentum in the stem cell research debate. You can join the conversation. If the rest of the world is plunging ahead, can the United States afford to stay behind on a key frontier of science? Do you remember when President Bush went on national TV to announce limits on stem cell research? Can you feel the wind shifting? If you were writing your congressman or woman tonight, yay or nay on stem cell research, which way would it be? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about a shifting momentum in the stem cell research debate. Nancy Reagan, academia, business, and increasingly the U.S. Congress saying, wait, we've got to do this. You can join our conversation tonight. Who is moving you on the stem cell question these days? Do the urgent needs of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and Lou Gehrig's disease sufferers outweigh the moral concerns here or not? And if the rest of the world is plunging ahead, can the U.S. afford to stay behind? Must it stay behind for moral reasons, for ethical reasons? Two first ladies have been speaking out very publicly in recent weeks and days on this. Nancy Reagan, whose husband, Ronald Reagan, died last week after a decade and more of Alzheimer's disease, one of the diseases among many that there is speculation could be treated eventually through stem cell research. Here's a clip from former First Lady Nancy Reagan speaking about embryonic stem cell research at a fundraiser for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation last month.
And now science has presented us with a hope called stem cell research, which may provide our scientists with many answers they have for so long been beyond our grasp. I just don't see how we can turn our backs on this. There are so many diseases that can be cured or at least helped. We've lost so much time already, and I just really can't bear to lose any more.
Nancy Reagan for stem cell research. Just yesterday, First Lady Laura Bush appeared on NBC's Today Show, saying that while her own father suffered from Alzheimer's and she sympathizes with Nancy Reagan, she sees moral and ethical concerns with stem cell research.
We're all advocates for a cure for Alzheimer's. I've worked for that for years myself because my dad also died of Alzheimer's. And there are stem cell that are available for research. But also we need to balance the interest in science with moral and ethical issues that have to do with embryonic stem cell use.
So where do you stand with Nancy Reagan or Laura Bush, with President Bush's restrictions, or with a call now coming from many senators and congressmen to open up this research? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been talking with Juan Enriquez, author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. We're joined now from Irvington, New York, by Daniel Callahan, co-founder and director of the International Program at the Hastings Center, an independent bioethics research institute. He's author of What Price Better Health? Hazards of the Research Imperative. He's a senior fellow at the Harvard Medical School. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Callahan.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, Daniel Callahan, you must watch this closely, and you can feel the pressure mounting. People feel the possibilities and the opportunity in stem cell, embryonic stem cell research. They want to do it. Do you think the president will hold the line? Should he hold the line?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. I think he should hold the line. But let me just recollect for everybody a little bit of history. 20 years ago, we heard that fetal tissue research was going to find a cure for Parkinson's disease.
And this during President Reagan's
tenure.
And
that has absolutely not happened, but there was a huge amount of hype and all sorts of celebrities supported that. And then we had the next move was for genetic therapy, and that was thought that we could just intervene surgically and otherwise and cure genetic disease. That has failed. And thirdly, we had the Human Genome Project, which started roughly 10 years ago. We spent $3 billion in that. And there the argument was that once we get the human genome mapped, we will find the cause of all diseases. You don't hear that anymore. That kind of hype has faded out, and everybody says, yes, it's really going to be a fairly tough thing. So my first response is, this is a classic advocacy kind of campaign, which is pioneered 20, 30 years ago. When you want to push something through Congress, when you want to get more money for the National Institutes of Health, you sign up celebrities and you put them to it. So,
but of course, at this point,
of course, the opponent.
Yeah.
And let me say something. You gave a credential. Let me say that I am pro-choice, a Democrat. I oppose everything Bush is doing except for this particular initiative, and I am not a religious person. So I was a little resentful when your first speaker from Time magazine talked about rigid conservatives. Well, I consider maybe I'm a rigid liberal, but
so you're saying you don't oppose abortion and it's not a religious issue with you, but you go first not to ethics but to efficacy here.
No, I turn to ethics. Let me lay out very quickly my ethical position. First of all, I don't think it's necessary to argue that life begins at conception in order to oppose stem cell research. we've had at least three national commissions which have said that there's sort of a middle position, which is that we ought to respect embryos. And my belief is that but nonetheless, we should respect them, but it's okay to use them for research. My position is that really makes no sense. How can you respect something you're basically going to destroy for your own benefits? That seems to me meaningless. But my main point also would be that I think, given the totally speculative nature of this research, and I do put it in the hype category, any serious scientist will say it may never work, and it's probably going to take at least 10 years before it does work. That's one point. And so you're really talking about, you know, you're destroying fetuses. You know, you're destroying embryos for something which may never pay off. So that it's not as if it's actually an equal struggle. The question is, why does the language kind of is, my God, if we don't do this, we'll never cure heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's.
And, well, you're putting the first flag up on the efficacy front right there. Daniel Callahan, let me get Juan Enriquez's response here. Mr. Enriquez, what about it? On the efficacy front, on the ethical front, how do you look at the question of stem cell research?
Well, I mean, first, you're talking often about eggs that have virtually been abandoned or embryos that have been abandoned that are going to be destroyed.
This is 400,000. We see Diane Feinstein and Barbara Boxer saying test tube embryos are believed to be in frozen storage in the United States now.
Right. And, I mean, the alternative that's being presented here is you should simply destroy them. We're beginning to learn enough. Think for a minute about the first people who did the Internet. There was one node on the Internet in September 1969. And those people didn't know where they were going, mm-hmm. and they didn't know what this research was going to go to. And you could have made exactly the same argument, which is, hey, why invest any money in this stuff? We have a perfectly decent phone system, and this doesn't seem to be leading anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time for anybody to even figure out how to make money on this stuff or how to make it useful to most people, because the people who were doing this research and mapping weren't thinking about email, and they weren't thinking about Google, and they weren't thinking about Amazon. And it took about 20 years to come up with a reasonable model on something that's an awful lot simpler than stem cell research. So to say that the human genome has been around now for 3 years, and, gee, it hasn't delivered, well, hey, DNA's been around for 51 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just beginning to understand what DNA can do and what genes can do. So
your concern is that if we do not continue to push this research aggressively, we won't learn what can be done here. We won't be in the vanguard of those who do learn and who profit from it.
Well, and I also think that there's a possibility that this country could significantly fall behind in research having to do with things like diabetes, like blindness, like spinal cord injuries, like skin regeneration, because a lot of the people who are absolutely passionate about this are people who are getting extraordinary opportunities in China, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in England, and they're showing up with packages for both tenured professors and postdocs that are quite extraordinary.
Saying, come hither, do your research here, we'll support you.
And you can already see this brain drain on a very significant scale out of the United States. I mean, you can see a drop in 30% in, you know, doctoral and postdoctoral students from other countries, up to 50% out of China. And unfortunately, the U.S. school system is not strong enough at this point to generate the amount of math and science graduates that are required to power this economy. So this is a country that's been importing a lot of brains. And in the measure that starts sticking restrictions on kids, be it visas, be it financing, be it restrictions on stem cell research, this has a cumulative effect of making this a place that's unpleasant to work in, to study in, to research in. You're already beginning to see that in very significant drop-offs in the amount of patents, in the amount of papers versus other countries, and even in the area of stem cell research.
Daniel Callahan, how about it? Are you suggesting the equivalent of, let's not investigate the Internet, we have phone lines?
No, that's ridiculous. What I would point out is that the National Institutes of Health has spent hundreds of millions of dollars over recent decades doing research in the very diseases and conditions that are supposedly going to be relieved by stem cell research. In the area of Parkinson's disease, for instance, there are at least 10 different lines of research, all of which are considered promising. Stem cell research is one among many promising lines. If we don't do that, we've got many other ways of skinning the same cat. And it seems to me one of the worst aspects of the hype is kind of the suggestion, my God, we'll never cure these deadly diseases if this research doesn't go forward. Well, I think that's absolutely false, and I think any serious scientist would say there are lots of other things. I would simply mention with Christopher Reeve, who has been one of the great proponents. Christopher Reeve, over the past year, has, A, been taken off a respirator and for much of his time, and secondly, now has some movement in his body. All of those improvements of Christopher Reeve came from standard ongoing NIH research. So the idea that somehow there's going to be a big blockbuster, I guess I'd want to ask Mr. Enriquez, but what about all the hype on this earlier things? I'm not saying that the Human Gene Project won't pay off in the long run, but what I'm saying is that nobody these days is talking about it finding the ultimate cure of all diseases. That's the kind of rhetoric which has cooled off considerably. And I mean, one can say of anything, my God, I mean, there's nothing you can't think of that might not pay off in the long run. But the National Institutes of Health spends $27 billion a year exploring all sorts of potential cures for disease. Why in the world should this one get a particular priority, particularly when it offends many of us, who are not, as your Times person said, rigid conservatives? I don't consider myself a rigid conservative.
Well, we've got it. Juan Enriquez, how do you respond?
Look, at various times, I mean, you have to go back in the history of this stuff. When people started discussing test tube babies, it was a concept that was absolutely alien to people. And the way in which it was even phrased, a test tube baby, it sounded absolutely horrible. You didn't know what was going to come out, if it was going to be somebody that was green or gray or, you know, even a human being, or what it was going to be. And there'd been one way for grandparents to get pregnant, one way for parents to get pregnant, and now all of a sudden there was this absolutely alien method. Now, the people who opposed that and who came out absolutely saying this should not be done, we should not have any in vitro fertilization, are some of the same people who are now opposing stem cell research. And they went on the record saying, you know, this is the end of humanity. This is going to lead to horrible things. This is going to lead to, you know, mutants. And, you know, lo and behold, now you've got hundreds of thousands of happy parents and kids that have been born perfectly normal because you went through something that originally looked yucky and today looks like a normal procedure. And I'd argue that stem cells are something that's going to look quite similar. Now, I agree that there are different ways of skinning a cat. And if we didn't do it through stem cell research, maybe it could be done in a different way in 10 years, in 15 years. I don't know. But if there's a chance of curing a series of diseases, if there's a chance of taking a series of human beings who are alive today and curing those diseases 10 years earlier or 5 years earlier than they otherwise might be, through embryos that are going to be destroyed anyway, I find this a very hard argument, and I find it an argument that's very similar to that of in vitro fertilization.
Juan Enriquez, Daniel Callahan, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. Catherine's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am opposed to stem cell research morally, ethically. In general, I just think that, you know, you need to have a certain respect for nature, and this, we've already gone beyond that respect for nature in many ways, but I think this is where I definitely draw the line. And I think the reason it's so easy for me to draw the line is because the logic that's been using, that's being used to support the stem cell research is profoundly flawed. For example, people say that, you know, there's people suffering from all these diseases, these disorders, mm-hmm. and you need to do research to find it out. Well, I think that sort of comes from a sense of entitlement that, you know, people deserve to live forever, or, you know, that just because there is some way out there that you should do it. And I don't think, I mean, you have to accept nature's limits.
But Catherine, isn't that what an awful lot of scientific progress has been about, saying let's investigate nature and find better ways to live?
Yes, but I think I also take issue with a lot of scientific research, and I'd like to tie into what your guest was saying earlier about people that had opposed test tube babies. I think there's a lot of people, myself included, who also continue to oppose that. Even though we sympathize with people who are unable to have children of their own and want to have children of their own, it's going too far. It's going beyond what we should do, you know what I'm saying?
I hear you, and I want to hear from both of our guests on this. And this is kind of the heart of
the gut level response of a lot of people. Daniel Callahan, I'll come
to
you.
I think there is a significant degree of uneasiness about using the embryo for research purposes, even whether people are pro-life or pro-choice. For instance, if you ask them, well, if you really think the embryo has no value at all, then why not just have women get pregnant in order to generate embryos for research, nothing else? And most people find that a discomforting idea. Well, the question is, I mean, you don't have to be a religious conservative to find that a discomforting idea. And I think people are kind of, I think they're very uneasy, and it seems to me we're getting a whole industry of sort of destroying fetuses. The fact that they're going to be discarded seems to me beside the point. If one thinks it is not a good thing to destroy embryos, even if they have a low comparative moral value, then the fact that, A, we're going to lose jobs overseas, or the fact that they're simply going to be thrown away seems to me irrelevant. I mean, after all, keep in mind that the Chinese argument for when they execute criminals, they say, well, they're going to die anyway, so why shouldn't we take their organs? We don't need to get their consent. So there's a long history of saying, well, things are going to happen anyway, so let's just capitalize on. I might also mention the overseas problem, an awful lot of human subject research where there has been serious abuse of people engaged in human research has been taken overseas. Why? Because it's easier to get it done there. There are fewer moral objections. And that whole phenomenon in itself is morally objectionable.
Juan Enriquez, what about the moral unease that our caller expresses? You are an advocate of pushing ahead down this path. How do you then factor in the moral unease factor?
I mean, it's a delicate balance between what people believe during a particular period of time and what they find to be true later on. And there were certainly times when we thought we were the be-all and end-all of the universe and we were the center of the universe. And, oh, by the way, if we wanted to live naturally, the chances are we would not survive. We came, as a species, actually very close to extinction. There were about 12,000 people left on the planet. And most women used to get married at 11 or 12, and they used to die just after their childbearing years. And the average natural life expectancy, or considered life expectancy, in 1900 was about 40 years old. When we had Social Security put into this country, you were not expected to live for more than 2 years past retirement. You're expected to live to 67. And because this research has gone on, you know, today being 65 or 67 or 70 is often considered young.
Mm-hmm.
So what is natural? I mean, what's natural is for us really not to survive to reproduce. It isn't natural for us to survive into adulthood, and it certainly isn't natural for us to survive into being grandparents. And it's things like penicillin and vaccines and the ability to detect disease and the medical research that's gone on that has changed these rules of the game. So if we really do want to go back to a natural world, that's a world without medicine. That's a world without electricity. And I think we've gone past that for the most part.
Juan Enriquez, Daniel Callahan, we've got a few more minutes with you. Please stick with us. We're talking tonight about a shifting momentum in the stem cell research debate. You can join the conversation. Which worries you more, a moral slippery slope or a scientific and economic slippery slope that would leave the United States behind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a shifting momentum in the stem cell research debate. Nancy Reagan, academia, business, and increasingly the U.S. Congress saying, wait, we've got to do this. 200 members of the House of Representatives calling on the Bush administration to loosen its restrictions on stem cell research just last Friday. 58 Democratic and Republican senators sending President Bush a letter urging the same. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think? We've been joined tonight by Juan Enriquez, chairman of Biotechonomy, a life sciences research and investment firm, and author of As the Future Catches You, and Daniel Callahan, co-founder and director of the International Program at the Hastings Center. It's an independent bioethics research institute. Bob is calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Listen, I just wanted to chime in on this. I'd like to tell you that I wish I had a choice. I don't feel as if I do. I'm the father of three boys, and they've all been diagnosed a long time ago with diabetes, insulin dependent.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand both sides of this argument, and I wish that I could be on the other side. But I think one of the staggering facts that people should speak to on this program is that if you have someone in your immediate family that's experienced these kind of illnesses, these kind of diseases that can ravage you, there isn't much choice to be made. You look into your kid's eye or your husband's eyes, and you got to go for the stem cell research. We have to do this.
And you say we have to do everything we can.
Right, right. And I wish that I didn't have kids with chronic illness. I look at the stem cell research, and it's pretty much the last bit of hope that I have of seeing a cure for diabetes anyway in my lifetime.
Bob, we hear it, and we can only imagine how it looks to you. Let's hear from Daniel Callahan on this. Daniel, what do you say? Here's the parent with the three children.
I'm sure, as he knows, the National Institutes of Health is spending lots of money. I take it does he think that money is being wasted, or that only stem cell research is likely to pay off?
No, but you can clearly hear that he thinks and that here's a big potential area for results. He doesn't want to see it ignored.
I think the fact you have children. Look, I have all sorts of relatives who have had Alzheimer's disease. I have a pretty good chance of getting it myself. I've had relatives that have heart disease. I have a pretty good chance of getting that myself. I had a mother and a grandmother who died from cancer. All of us can find some reason, a family reason, why we want research to go forward. But it seems to me that that does not make for a good moral argument. That is a purely self-interested kind of argument. And the trouble with that, even though it's sort of well-motivated self-interest, nonetheless, it tends to run roughshod over all sorts of other moral problems.
And yet there's an interest in those children's and those victims' situations. Well, I want to get one more call before the end of the show. David's calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. I'm similar to Bob. Unfortunately, 2 years ago, I suffered from a hockey injury and got a spinal cord injury in my C3, C4 that's left me a quadriplegic. Mm. And it's when it hits you at home, I hear Mr. Callahan out there saying he's got these people in his family that have, died from Alzheimer's and have had cancer, and God forbid it hits him, and I hope it doesn't. But when I hear the argument that Barbara Boxer is saying that there are 400,000 frozen embryos that are going to be discarded, the same that were used by Harvard's, the doctor there that came out with the new stem cell lines.
Right, Douglas Morton.
Yeah, correct. And we won't fund that, so let's throw it away rather than fund it. I don't understand the logic. And it's always, if it hits you at home, then you understand it. I remember Brady, who worked for President Reagan.
Jim Brady on gun control, right.
He was huge on the NRA, and bingo, lo and behold, his wife is making a major charge on the Brady gun bill.
And it can change things in a big hurry, and we hear you, quadriplegic, looking at this and saying, what can be done here? Juan Enriquez, we don't have much time left, but how do you look at there are clearly personal stakes here for our caller Bob and his children, for David and his own, and his broken spinal cord.
But I might mention that I lost a child to sudden infant death syndrome, which has not been solved. So I think I understand loss perfectly well.
We take your point. Juan Enriquez, how do you see the stakes here personally and nationally?
I think if there's any chance of taking a disease out 10 years early, 5 years early, if there's a chance of helping people who are alive today with things that are going to be discarded, with embryos that are going to be discarded, we have to do it. And we're talking about things really in a blastocyst stage. I mean, these aren't fully formed fetuses. These are really early cell divisions. And I think it is absolutely essential for this country to move forward on this research. I think it's the hardware for all the investment we've made in decoding things like the genome.
So do this, or you won't be able to use that. This debate will go on, but we can feel the wind shifting a little bit in the last few days. Daniel Callahan and Juan Enriquez, I want to thank both of you. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Callahan is co-founder of the international program at the Hastings Center, an independent bioethics research institute. Juan Enriquez, founding director of the Harvard Business School Life Science Project and author of As the Future Catches You, How Genomics and Other Forces Are Changing Your Life, Work, Health, and Wealth. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Iraq's new prime minister appeases Kurdish leaders, but for how long? This is On Point. Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said yesterday that he would honor the interim constitution agreed to in March until elections are held next year. The interim constitution recognizes the autonomy of the Kurdish region and gives the Kurds guarantees to protect it. Kurdish leaders had threatened to abandon the new Iraqi state if the interim constitution was not recognized, and they reacted cautiously to yesterday's news and continue to discuss the possibility of secession. Peter Galbraith is senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington. His op-ed piece, entitled "There Is One Way to Preserve Iraq and Give Us a Way Out, a Federation of Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish States Will Avoid Civil War," recently appeared in the British newspaper The Guardian. He joins me now. Good evening and welcome, Peter Galbraith.
Good evening.
It seemed like quite a dance we saw this week. All of a sudden, the Kurds, who seemed on board, were ready to bolt because the guarantees in the interim constitution appeared to be floating away. They actually physically, Kurdish leaders left Baghdad and went north. How sensitive a hair trigger are we on with this issue, Peter Galbraith? Do the Kurds think that somehow they're being sold down the river?
This problem has not been solved at all. The root of the problem is this. The Kurds have had what was de facto an independent state for 13 years. As part of a bargain in March, they agreed to give up some of their autonomy, surrender some power to the central government, in return for protections that the permanent constitution of Iraq would not be approved unless they consented. Mm-hmm. And all this was incorporated into the transitional administrative law, the interim constitution, which was greeted with a lot of fanfare and self-congratulation by the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
However, it was done in secret by American lawyers, no public discussion, and once the Ayatollah Sistani, Iraq's most prominent Shiite leader, read it, he began to object. And in particular, he objected to the very provisions that protected the rights of the Kurds in terms of ratifying the permanent constitution. This week, the Bush administration had a choice between sticking with that interim constitution or accommodating the Ayatollah Sistani. They chose to accommodate the Ayatollah Sistani by not including the interim constitution in the Security Council resolution. What that means legally is that the interim constitution is not valid as of July 1, because no law from the occupation period can be valid unless it's in the Security Council resolution mm-hmm. or adopted by the new government. Prime Minister Alawi has said that he will keep this new constitution, the interim constitution, until elections, but that doesn't interest the Kurds at all. Their concern was what happens after the elections. They don't want to see a Shiite majority being able to impose its will on them.
What's the particular guarantee in the interim constitution that the Kurds are so keen on keeping?
There is Article 61C of the Interim Constitution says that the Constitution, the permanent Constitution, will come into effect only when ratified by a majority of Iraqis and only if the Constitution is not rejected by three of Iraq's governorates by a two-thirds vote in each of those governorates.
This effectively giving the Kurds a veto over the way Iraq comes together?
If in fact, the Kurdish area overwhelmingly opposes the new constitution, that is by two-thirds in each of the three Kurdish governorates, mm-hmm. then that constitution would not come into effect. Incidentally, this is quite normal in constitution writing. A constitution's never a majority document. It's a consensus document. Our own constitution only came into effect when it was approved by 9 of the 13 states and only among those 9. To amend it, it requires a two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the states.
Peter Galbraith, do you think that Iraq is locked into a conflict here? What's the bottom line of the Kurds? What's the bottom line of what will be the Shia majority, and can they live together?
We are much closer to the breakup of Iraq, and largely because of the choice that the administration made when it chose to go with Sistani rather than with its own interim constitution. The Kurds have been increasingly dubious about Iraq because of the chaos that they've seen in the south. Then 2 weeks ago, when the interim government was being formed, President Bush's representative, Ambassador Robert Blackwell, came up and met with them, and he said a Kurd can't be president or prime minister. The president has to be a Sunni Arab, and the a Shiite has to be the prime minister. And although this was a statement to them that you're second-class citizens. They reacted angrily to this. And finally, this breaking of the interim constitution, that's the last straw. They know that they can maintain their own state, and they're not likely they're likely to keep their distance. It's a cumulative process that is, I think, leading to the dissolution of Iraq.
So you're describing the United States as having essentially cast its lot with the Shiite leader Ayatollah Sistani because the Shiites are the majority, because they were having trouble in the South, they needed to get things quiet and under control?
All of those things, and in addition, Sistani complained. And this is a classic case where the United States tends to accommodate the complainer, tends to accommodate the opponent at the expense of the friends. And the Kurds feel that they were America's only reliable friends. They'd fought side by side with American troops in the war last March and April, and that they had very strongly supported what the United States wanted to do. So there's a real sense now among the Kurdish leaders and Kurdish people that they've been double-crossed by the United States.
And this in spite of Prime Minister Ayatollahi saying, no, it's fine, I give you my guarantee, we'll stick with this. They want it in the resolution or it doesn't count, the U.N. resolution.
It's not, unless it's in the U.N. Security Council resolution, it will not bind the elected government. Alawi has only offered to keep it in effect through until the elections. That's of no interest to the Kurds. That's only the phase where they've given up some of their autonomy. Where they got something in return was what happened after the elections when they got, in essence, a veto over the permanent constitution.
And what's the Shiite objection to continuing Kurdish autonomy? Why is that a problem?
Well, there are some Shiite leaders who do wish to, who are willing to continue Kurdish autonomy. And indeed, some of them would have accepted a provision that the Kurds had originally proposed that said that the constitution would not come into effect in Kurdistan unless approved by a majority of the people in Kurdistan. But it was the Americans, Ambassador Bremer, who changed it to three governorates because he didn't want any reference to something that had the word Kurdish or Kurdistan in it. And that gives the Sunni Arabs a veto as well. And that is part of the Shiite objection.
Peter Galbraith, we just have half a minute left. Can Iraq break up into pieces without destroying itself, without destroying its resource base, just without calamity?
It can if the process is managed, and that means resolving the territorial disputes among the different entities, ensuring that there's sharing of resources, although, in fact, there's oil in all three parts. And it may be less calamitous than trying to hold it together, particularly in the manner in which we've been doing. But it's going to require a lot more skill and diplomacy than we've demonstrated to date.
Civil war more or less likely after this week?
The breakup of Iraq is more likely, and unless that process is managed, civil war is much more likely.
Peter Galbraith, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you again.
Peter Galbraith, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Rachel Gottbaum and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.